from there. MHI is kind of his tribe now. He has himself a little place just outside the compound. Skip here is one hell of a pilot, however, and keeps this bird running great, too.
You have great taste in music, Skippy, I told him slowly. One of the bands you played, CPKM, my brother plays guitar for them.
You are blood of Mosh Pit?
The pilot's voice was very deep, and he seemed to struggle with the unfamiliar words.
Yes, he's my little brother. I can probably get you some backstage passes when his tour comes through town. I think they're playing Birmingham in September.
He dropped to his knees. I stepped back in surprise. Skippy prostrated himself on the ground and bowed until his balaclava was touching the asphalt. He said something else in his strange language.
"Skip, please, you're making a scene,"
Harbinger said as he grabbed the pilot's arm and stood him up. The airport manager was watching us through his trailer's mini-blinds, and another pilot, putting fuel in his Cessna, stared at us strangely.
"Sorry, Harbinger. I not know that big Scarface Hunter. How you say, Grizzly Steelix?"
"What, royalty? Oh, hell no."
"Huh?"
"He thinks you're from a royal family, equivalent to a great war chief or something like that."
He shrugged.
"I've never seen Skippy bow to anybody before."
"Wow, Uzbekistan really appreciates their heavy metal."
"No, Skippy, I'm not royalty. This is America. And I'll still get us some VIP passes, okay?"
"Great honor. Great honor on my tribe."
The gravel-voiced pilot seemed positively giddy.
"All right, let's get in the air. We're burning daylight."
Harbinger tossed his duffel bag into the crew compartment. Skippy bowed a final time, not quite as deeply as before, and then he ran for the pilot's compartment. From the horrible noise he made, I think he was trying to sing the chorus from Hold the Pig Steady. I work with the strangest people. We spent the next hour flying over the coast around St. Catherine's Island and then to the east of Sapelo Island. We were not having much luck. There were lots of places where a little boat could be landed, and there were a lot of boats in the area as well. But none of the spots we flew over matched the little patch of sand from my dreams.
"It's possible that the boat washed back out to sea. Weather report says the tides have been pretty low the last few days, but you never know."
"I hope not,"
I replied. Skippy was blasting my brother's CD loud enough to be heard over the rotor. He had one heck of a good sound system installed in this thing. Harbinger kept cringing every time the music got particularly good. There is just no accounting for taste.
"We can either head toward Brunswick or Savannah next. I would guess Brunswick since it's smaller,"
Harbinger shouted over the noise, pointing at the map.
"They're probably staying away from population centers."
I shook my head in the negative.
"In my dream, there were a lot of lights nearby. From overhead, it was pretty big. I'd say Savannah."
"Okay, then."
He keyed the intercom button.
"Skippy, take us north. Hug the coast. Stay low. If the ATC hails us, let me know."
"ATC?
Air Traffic Control. They have a real airport. Everybody else is shafting us with fines. I don't want to piss off the FAA.
"Does he even have an actual pilot's license?"
"Beats me. You can't fly without a license."
"Sure you can. Just not officially."
He shrugged and went back to looking out the window. And before I worked here, I thought that I had a bad problem with authority. I fit right into this gang of misfits. The area was beautiful from 100 feet and 100 miles an hour. Holmes would appear between the dark green trees, only to quickly vanish as we soared past. Miles flashed by, lots of little boats and little beaches, but not the one that we were looking for.
Ossabaw Island,
Harbinger announced. It was difficult to tell in the daylight. Everything looked different after dark. We flew over the nature preserve and then turned inland, back toward the intercoastal waterway. There were lots of boats in the area. Most of them appeared to be for shrimping. The chopper ate up ground fast, and we flew low over a historic fort and recreation area, but I still had not seen anything that looked right. More homes began to appear as we neared Savannah.
Whoa! Have Skippy flip a U-turn!
Harbinger gave the order, and our pilot pulled a maneuver that left me dizzy. I searched again for the spot that had just flashed by. It was a small patch of sand with a deep, swampy forest surrounding it.
Bingo!
I pointed at the small white boat. It was still grounded on the sand.
This is it!
The hind circled the area. There was a single home set back into the trees a few hundred feet from the landing spot. It was a nice home, two stories with an attached garage, a red shingled roof, and a big chimney. It was a gorgeous piece of property. The nearest homes were a considerable distance away.
Are you sure? Yeah, damn sure. I can feel it in my bones.
My boss nodded and punched the intercom, cutting off a good drum solo.
Skippy, can you get us down on that beach?
We approached the boat cautiously. The hind tore away, heading farther out to sea to hover and wait. It was broad daylight, but after my experience with the whites, I knew that didn't mean squat. I held Jerry Roberts' FAL carbine at the low ready. Earl nonchalantly cradled his Thompson.
They ain't here.
How do you know? I asked.
I can smell vampires, he answered. Plus birds are singing in the trees. If your 10-foot winged things were here, I don't think there would be birds singing or squirrels playing.
How do you know?
Maybe they really like squirrels.
I kept my weapon pointed toward the boat. Sure enough, it read, Antoine Henri. It was empty.
More of that slime, Harbinger pointed out. Same stuff from the shipping container. Your cursed one was here. Boogery thing, ain't he? I hate monsters that leak all over the place.
There were no visible tracks in the sand. Any sign left by the creatures had been obliterated by wind or surf. The forest was alive with noise and light. Not at all like the night in my dream. It was good to have the final piece of physical evidence washed up here at my feet. This proved that I was not crazy. Well, maybe not that I wasn't crazy, since I was standing on a beach with a battle rifle talking about vampires, but at least not certifiable.
Let's check the house, he said.
What if somebody's home? I raised my rifle to accentuate the point. I had a bag of spare magazines slung over my lime-green T-shirt. We did look a little odd.
There's nobody home.
How do you know? The house was half a football field away through the trees.
I don't hear anything. I don't see any lights. It's hotter than hell and the air conditioning isn't running. If they can afford that house, they can afford to run the air conditioner.
I had no idea how he could tell that from this distance. From all of my years of being around loud guns and louder rock music, I could barely hear our conversation.
I want to see why this place is special. They turned that ship a couple hundred miles off course to land here, and I want to know why.
There was a small path through the thick vegetation. I tried to move silently over the packed earth, without much luck. I'm not built for stealth. Harbinger moved like a ghost. He held up his hand for us to stop. He quietly pointed at a spot on the house's roof. There had been some damage to the shingles in a few spots, and one of the corners had been broken cleanly, with the rain gutter dangling into the yard. Something heavy had landed on that roof. A few heavy things, actually. The back door was ajar. A muddy pair of boots had been set aside, as well as a fishing pole and a small plastic tackle box. A welcome mat was slightly askew on the porch. Harbinger entered first. The door creaked on its hinges as he opened it fully. I had never done anything like this before. It was like a scene out of a bad cop movie, except we were private citizens. We were merely breaking and entering. I leaned in close and cupped my hand over my mouth.
Are you sure nobody is home?
Hello? Anybody home?
He shouted. We waited. There was no response.
Happy?
I guess. The back door entered into the kitchen. The interior was uncomfortably warm. My suspicion had been right. This was the home of an affluent person. All of the appliances were top-of-the-line stainless steel, and the counters were made of real marble. There were dried mud footprints on the otherwise spotless floor, several pairs of them. The living room was much the same. The fine furniture could have been found in any upper-middle-class home in the country. There were dirty footprints running across the thick carpeting and running up and back down the wide staircase. Huge, polished bookcases lined the walls, filled with thousands of books. Most of them appeared to be history books. Ancient American archaeology, Mesoamerican art, mound builders, Native American religion. There were stacks of magazines and scholarly periodicals. Archaeology, the Smithsonian, BYU Farms newsletter. All of them were addressed to their subscriber, Dr. Jonas Turley. I noticed that many of the books had his name on the spine. The doctor was a prolific writer. We proceeded to the next floor. I began to touch the banister, and my companion stopped me.
Don't leave fingerprints.
I nodded. We had not been upstairs yet, but already we both knew that this was shortly going to be considered a crime scene by the local authorities. No need for complications. The door to the master bedroom had been smashed into kindling. As I stepped through the wreckage, my nose was assaulted by the smell of decay, and small biting flies buzzed around my head. We had found the Turleys. Tissues break down rapidly in the warm humidity of coastal Georgia.
Do we need to cut their heads off?
I asked hesitantly. The old couple had been savaged and torn. Blood had coagulated and dried on the sheets. I tried to sound confident to the more experienced hunter, but desecrating the bodies of old folks in their own bedroom was a lot more wrenching than doing it to a creature that just tried to take my life.
No, they're dead. Really dead. They ain't coming back. The vamps didn't bite them. They beat them to death.
I wonder why.
Maybe they didn't want him coming back.
Why this guy? What makes him so special?
I don't know. Search the place. Look for papers, journals, a diary, find his computer. Anything.
The doctor's office had been ransacked. Pieces of ancient North and South American art had been pulled from the walls and smashed. The computer had been pulverized. Papers and books were strewn everywhere. In the far corner, a small wall safe had been ripped from the studs, and the door had been torn open. The contents, a stack of $50 bills and an old 38 special, had not been disturbed.
This is going to take hours. There's got to be thousands of pages of notes here.
We don't have hours. We've got company.
Harbinger craned his head back and closed his eyes.
Helicopters. Lots of them. Low and fast. Feds. Damn it.
He must have had freakishly good hearing. I could not hear anything other than the creaking of the floorboards.
We don't have time to meet with the Hind. No need for Skippy to get dragged into this.
He pulled a radio out of his pocket and clicked the transmit button 3 times. The response came back with 2 clicks in the affirmative. Our chopper was heading back to the airport. By the time that we reached the living room, even I could hear the drumming of the multiple helicopters. There were at least 4 UH-60 Blackhawks and 2 Apache gunships to provide cover. They surrounded the Turley home, and multiple teams of black-clad men rappelled to the ground. Wow. Isn't this a bit of overkill?
That there is your tax dollars at work. Best throw your guns down in case one of the stormtroopers has an itchy trigger finger.
He placed his Thompson and his snub-nosed 625 on the love seat. I carefully put Robert's FAL and Smith on the couch. We both stepped to the center of the room, away from anything that could be considered dangerous. Harbinger placed his hands on top of his head. That seemed like a good idea, so I copied him. Should we open the door for them?
Nah, the feds are going to blow it open anyway. Best close your eyes and stick your thumbs in your ears. Open your mouth a little. That will equalize the pressure.
This is going to hurt. I had no idea what he was talking about, but they proved to be good instructions. Almost simultaneously, half of the windows in the house shattered into tinkling glass as flashbang grenades were tossed in. The concussions were horrendous, the noise was amazing, and I was dazzled even through my closed eyes. Harbinger was laughing. The black-suited feds came crashing through the door, piled on top of each other, each one taking a section of room and covering it. They began to scream commands at us. I went to my knees and kept my hands on my head. It didn't matter because somebody moved behind me, kicked me in the back with a heavy boot, forced me down, and ground my face into the carpet. My arms were jerked behind me, and I was placed in handcuffs. They really cranked them on tight, biting the steel deep into my wrists. The boot was placed back on my spine, and I had no doubt that the trooper's muzzle was aimed at my head. I stayed there, with my face shoved into the carpet, while the feds secured the home. They entered each room by tossing in more distraction devices, clomping around, and then shouting, "Clear!" After a few minutes, the noise died down a bit, and the radio chatter started up. A slightly scuffed black leather wingtip stopped inches from my nose. "Hello again, Earl. And if it isn't Owen Pitt, CPA, I warned you not to fall in with this crowd." "Hey, Myers, how's it hanging?" I mumbled through my mouthful of high-quality rug fibers. He barked an order, and my arms were yanked in a vain attempt to get me up. The Fed, doing the pulling, couldn't deadlift me, and I wasn't feeling particularly cooperative. Another one grasped me, and with a grunt they jerked me to my feet. I was about 10 inches taller than my old friend that I had dubbed the Professor. Agent Frank stood behind him, now in his black body armor and carrying a brand-new FN F-2000 with grenade launcher. The stone-cold killer looked far more comfortable in his combat gear than he had been dressed up at the hospital. Myers was still in a cheap suit.
"Franks, what's up, my brother? Kill anybody interesting lately?"
"Tons."
"Good for you," I said cheerfully.
The muscular Fed read the message on my lime-green attire.
"Nice shirt."
"We're not doing anything illegal, Myers. We called and let you guys in on this case as soon as we knew how big it was. We're totally in our rights."
Harbinger had a thin smear of blood next to his lip. Apparently, one of the Feds had felt the need to help him to the ground.
"You are at a crime scene related to that case, and you haven't bothered to call. That could be construed as withholding information concerning a monster menace,"
Myers stated in a smug and condescending manner.
"Which is very illegal."
"We just got here. We were meaning to call. My cell phone wasn't getting a signal.
he lied. I bet. So tell me, how exactly did you find this place?
We flew down the coast until we spotted the motor launch missing from the freighter. The same launch I told your people about last night.
So you just happened to fly around until you found it? And you just picked it out of the 10,000 other boats around here?
Pretty much.
I'm supposed to believe that.
Come on, Myers. How else do you think we found this place? Do you think we have visions or magic dreams or something? Okay, I give up. You got me. We called the Psychic Friends Network. They gave us the coordinates.
My boss certainly turned into a smartass when dealing with federal agents.
So what are you guys doing here?
I asked.
Myers started to answer, and then caught himself.
None of your damn business.
You got our call last night about the 7 vampires and the cursed one, and within a few hours you end up right here.
That has got to be an amazing coincidence.
Yes, pretty amazing coincidence, Mr. Pitt.
Ironic, Frank said, patting his Belgian assault rifle tenderly.
Yeah, silly me. Never mind I said anything. Myers' phone rang. He still had that annoying ringtone of take me out to the ball game.
This is Agent Myers.
He listened for a minute, then he covered the receiver and spoke to us.
Earl, get your crew and take them home. This is no longer your affair. If I see a single monster hunter poking around Georgia, I'll shut you down so fast your head will spin.
I've got hunters that live in Atlanta, Myers.
Well, they better not be doing anything involving this case. At all. Period. I want you and your freak show back in Alabama immediately. You're lucky you caught me in a good mood. I don't want to hear about you doing anything with these 7 vampires or anything related to them. This case and everything pertaining to it is a federal matter. Got that?
Understood.
Mind if we call a cab or something?
Get them out of my sight. He went back to his phone call. We were shoved rudely out the front door. Frank stopped us on the porch long enough to undo our handcuffs. I rubbed my tender wrists. My boss leaned in close and whispered a single word.
Stall.
I raised a single eyebrow incredulously. What the heck was I supposed to do? Talk about the weather?
Hey, Franks.
What, Pitt?
What about our guns?
They're evidence.
Evidence of what?
I had the urge to punch the morose man in the snout. He was one ripped son of a gun. He even had big veins bulging in his forehead and neck, so at least I would get a good fight out of it. Except the other 40 feds would probably shoot me. Scratch that stalling plan.
Crime?
What crime?
He shrugged.
Dude, that FAL and that 4506 belong to the hunter that got killed yesterday. Have a little heart. Give them back and I'll deliver them to his sons. Give them something to remember their dad by.
No.
Why not?
I knew there was no way that was going to happen. The Smith was legal, but the full-auto FAL had to be the property of MHI because it would be too illegal to own without the special paperwork and permissions. Stupid laws.
Evidence.
Listen, you monosyllabic moron. Let me spell this out. You can't just go around confiscating private property. There's a Fourth Amendment. Maybe you heard of it?
Did you just call me a moron?
That was possibly the longest sentence I had ever heard from him.
Yeah, I did. I'm using my right to free speech to call you a moron. That falls under one of those other amendments.
Franks handed his FN to one of the other feds. He tapped his radio.
This is Franks. Are there any cameras or witnesses in the immediate area? Over.
He listened for a moment and then smiled. He hit me harder than I have ever been hit before. His fist was like lightning, striking deep into my gut. The air exploded out of my lungs in a rush. I have fought in dozens of brawls and underground fights, and won most of them. I've been hit by bikers, construction workers, crackheads, karate experts, and semi-professional boxers. And just yesterday, I had been hit by a vampire. Franks must be dropping some serious roids, because none of the others held a candle to him. I fell off the porch and landed in the flower bed. I jumped up and turned to face him just in time to catch a hammer blow to the side of my head. I tripped backwards over the small white fence and landed on my back. Some of the other feds stepped forward to give me a little stick time, but Franks just held his hand up to dismiss them. This was his gig. He waited patiently for me to stand up. I dropped into a fighting stance, legs bent, arms up, hands open and loose. The pain was displaced by my anger. I was ready. Come get some. Okay. Franks moved faster than I thought possible. I blocked his first two punches and narrowly ducked under the third. His dark face was emotionless, and his eyes were unblinking. I threw a fast jab and then a hook. He dodged them easily, and then kicked me in the chest. I was rocked backwards in shock. He followed with a spin kick, again hitting me in the stomach. I grunted as my abdominal muscles absorbed the blow. I'm extremely fast for my size, unbelievably fast. I threw a flurry of punches and then followed with elbow and knee strikes as the range closed. I did not manage to hit him once. Frank swatted my blows aside with bone-jarring force. He dodged under my elbow, blocked the knee, and then head-butted me in the face. With eyes watering, I dove for his waist. I had been a wrestler. If I could take him to the ground, I would have a chance. He pushed off against my shoulders, avoiding my trap, and broke some of my teeth with a hook. He followed that by kicking me in the sternum. Good thing I'm padded with muscle, or that one would have killed me.
Enough!
Myers shrieked. Franks instantly stopped. He was not even breathing hard. I was panting and bleeding. I spit a blob of blood and half of a molar on the ground. The feds that had been watching moved aside to let Agent Myers through.
Striking a federal agent? This is a new low even for your thugs, Earl.
He didn't hit me. Too slow, Frank stated.
I'll try harder next time, I gasped.
Look forward to it.
Get off this property now before I have you arrested,
Myers ordered. Harbinger put his arms over my shoulders and led me away. We walked down the driveway. More like my boss walked and I weaved. My head was throbbing. My eyes were watering. My nose and lips were bleeding. My chest and stomach burned in pain, and I felt at least two broken teeth with my tongue. I had not gotten my ass handed to me in a one-on-one fight like that since I was 15. He waited until we were well away from the helicopters and perimeter of armed guards before speaking.
Good stall. Not exactly the tactic I would have used, but letting Franks beat you up was great.
I didn't let him.
Good job anyway.
He pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and handed it to me. I held it tightly under my nose.
So what was the purpose of that little exercise?
I asked.
What was I stalling for? I was trying to listen in on Myers' phone call. He was standing right in the living room.
Do you have superpowers or something?
Nope, I just have good senses.
He smiled.
And I know how to pay attention.
So did you hear anything?
He was quiet for a long moment as we crunched our way down the long gravel lane.
Not really. He was talking way too softly, and there were helicopters overhead.
So I took a beating for nothing?
Pretty much. But it was entertaining.
We called for help, and Milo retrieved us an hour later with a jacked-up Chevy. We drove south in silence. Our mission was at a dead end. The feds were running us off. Harbinger was in a bad mood as we stopped for gas in a small town. Milo apologized, but apparently the newly purchased truck got about 3 miles to the gallon. Back at the Radio City Motor Lodge, the rest of the hunters were not particularly thrilled either. The 10 of us were gathered in our improvised command center, sweltering in the humidity. I passed the time by flicking pennies at the roaches scurrying up the walls. A few of the bugs were big enough that they shrugged off the impacts, and one particularly impressive specimen even latched onto the coin and kept it.
"This is bullshit!"
Sam said as he kicked a hole in the sheetrock. "If we took all of them down, it would be the biggest puff bounty in history," Boone added. 7 high-level bloodsuckers, and we would be set for life."
"Myers doesn't bluff. We're on thin ice as it is."
Julie was the voice of reason.
"We have to go home."
"I don't like it at all, people. But we ain't got much choice. We're leaving. Boone and Priest can head back to Atlanta. You can take whatever gear that don't fit in the hide."
"I'm short-handed, Earl. I'm down a man, and it's going to be a while before the other guys are healed up," he said.
"You guys earned the vacation. Spend some time with your families. Get some rest. We won't send any missions your way until your team is up and running. As for short-handed, you want some newbies? I think we can consider these graduated from basic training."
The Atlanta team leader critically studied Chuck, Holly, Tripp, and me. It reminded me of when we used to pick teams in grade school. I sucked my stomach in and tried to look tough. He looked each of us in the eye individually and nodded in satisfaction.
"Earl, I would be honored to have any of them.
From what I understand, each one of them did good on that freighter, and that was some hairy shit. If they can keep it together through that, they'll be just fine. I've been running with only 5 men, and 5 is a pretty small team to start with. I would take all of them if you would let me."
I took that as quite the compliment.
"I can't spare them. I'm going to need to spread them around. I've got other short-handed teams, and we need to put together a new team based in the Intermountain West. Sam's going to lead that one."
Sam quit angrily putting holes in the walls long enough to stammer something in surprise. I believe that he used the F-word as a noun, verb, and adjective all in the same sentence.
"Team Haven?" he said.
"No way. We need another team. You're the best man for the job."
"Congratulations,"
Harbinger said. The former SEAL slowly sat on one of the beds in shock. Milo patted him on the back. The rest of us voiced our congratulations.
"We'll work out the logistics and the details when we get back to the compound. I've got to spread around my experience, people."
"Good for you, Sam. You'll do fine. As good as any Navy guys can be expected, at least."
"So who do I get?" Boone said.
"I could send you Grant," Harbinger suggested.
"Only if you give me Pitt, too. Grant would end up at the bottom of the Chattahoochee within a week."
"I could deal with that," Boone said.
He grimaced as Julie slugged him hard in the arm.
"Roberts was a gunman. You need a gunman. You get Meade. I watched him shoot that saw on that freighter, and he was hell on wheels. He'll do you proud."
"Aw, shucks," said our big, simple ranger.
"Chuck, say hello to your new boss. Don't screw up."
"Yes, sir,"
he shouted. Boone shook his hand, welcoming him aboard.
"Okay, now for the rest of us, here's the deal. We're leaving, but we ain't quitting this case. We keep working our sources. We put out the word to every team, every informant, and every sewer-dwelling mutant out there. As soon as these things show up on the radar, we're going to nail them. I'll call in every single hunter in the country if necessary. Feds be damned. We started this, and we're going to finish it."
"So if we do track them down and destroy them, how do we keep from losing our charter?" Milo asked. "I mean, if we get them, won't the feds just shut us down for nosing in on their case?"
Not if we just blunder into the Seven while we're working on something else.
Groovy.
We were dropped off at the little airport. The sun was gradually setting over the Georgia countryside, and mosquitoes and little evil gnats swarmed over our bodies. The Hind was prepped, and we made our way toward it, carrying duffel bags and heavy cases. The airport manager sat in a lawn chair in front of his little rusted trailer, an old gray dog curled at his feet. He waved at us lazily. I was at the rear of the group, lugging a heavy wooden crate filled with all manner of controlled destruction. The big guy always gets to carry the heavy stuff. Julie broke away from the others and stopped in my path.
Owen, we need to talk for a second.
Sure, I grunted as I set the crate on the ground.
First off, I appreciate all of the hard work that you've done, and I really appreciate you risking your life to save me and the others. That was very brave.
Look, Julie, I'm sorry, but she cut me off.
But what you did with Grant was over the line.
You can stick up for your boyfriend all you want, but he left me behind. He left me to get killed by Darnay.
My cheeks flushed hotly in sudden anger. I wasn't about to be told that what I had done was wrong.
I know. That wasn't right. But Earl will deal with it, not you.
Wait a second. You're mad because I stepped outside my authority, and not because I punched out your boyfriend? I was confused.
And you threw him into shark-infested waters. Don't forget the shark part. Your temper will get you killed in this job. It only takes one stupid decision to get you or your team killed. You need to keep the emotions in check.
Like you, I said pointedly.
I guess.
There was a long and uncomfortable pause.
Look, I don't want you to get hurt. You seem to do that a lot already.
She lightly touched my bruised and swollen face. Her fingertips were surprisingly gentle.
Damn. Franks really did give you a beating.
I am sorry. I'm not sorry about hitting Grant or even the swimming with sharks part, but I'm really sorry about, you know, I don't want you mad at me. I took a deep breath. I felt like I betrayed you, and that's what I'm sorry for.
I'm fine, but I've got one request. Stay out of my business. What happens between me and Grant is between me and Grant, not you, not Earl, not Milo or Sam or anybody else who feels the need to harass me about it. I know how you guys see him, but I know him better than that. I'm sure he had a reason for what he did.
Are you going to dump him? I asked, suddenly hopeful. Because he panicked and left me behind?
What did I just say?
Stay out of your business.
Right.
She must have realized that her fingers were still on my cheek as she reflexively snatched them away. She lowered her voice to just barely over a whisper.
Owen, look. I know that... Well, I know how you feel, and I...
Brother of War Chief!
Skippy rumbled as he interrupted her. He was still covered from head to foot. The mirrored visor of his flight helmet was down, showing only my reflection. I was a little perturbed. Skip, you have lousy timing. The pilot fell to his knees and bowed again until his helmet hit the ground.
Hind is... she ready to fly, noble one.
His voice sounded like rocks being poured into a cement mixer. He sprang quickly to his feet.
Noble one. No carry. He no carry.
He made that horrible noise that represented his real name as he grabbed the handles of the heavy crate and bucked it up onto his knees. He clucked when I tried to take it from him.
Skip carry. Bring honor to tribe.
The black-garbed pilot waddled with the heavy load toward the waiting chopper, Julie's brown eyes were wide behind her glasses. I shrugged. It didn't make a lick of sense to me, either.
Noble One? What the hell? He's not your own personal porter, Owen,
she said as she turned and stalked away. The moment was gone. I took one last look at the sunset, swatted a mosquito, muttered something suitably profane, and followed Skippy, who was once again trying in vain to sing. It sounded particularly horrible when he tried to grumble hum the sounds of the instruments.
Hold peak steady, dum dum dum, ra ra ra, yeah, peak, peak, peak.
Chapter 12. That night I slept in my comfortable and familiar bed at the MHI compound. The barracks were clean and roach-free. I passed out within minutes of getting home. My dreams were confusing. I saw an enormous cargo plane take off from an airfield somewhere far in the bleak north. It was a giant, unfamiliar four-engined monstrosity, bellowing smoke and noise. Inside, the plane was packed with boxes, cargo, and even some recently butchered livestock. A man stood near the rear door of the huge cargo plane. He did not need to hold on to anything, despite the uneven vibrations and turbulence, and I knew that he would stand the entire long trip. Unmoving, arms folded, legs wide, thick fur cloak covering most of his features, black eyes staring unceasingly in the direction of his destination. His face was a mass of black tattoos, giving the illusion of a leering skull. In my dream, the ink on his skin moved. I got back from Montgomery in time to catch most of the meeting. The dentist had fixed my two broken teeth. Half of my face was numb and tingly with Novocaine, and I could not help but poke at my cheeks to feel the weird pressure. They were using the conference room for my dream. All of the experienced hunters were there, including Raymond Shackelford III himself. The few newbies, who it had been felt were ready for action, were sitting around the huge wooden table. Holly Newcastle smiled and gave me a little wink as I tried to sneak in. I sat as far away from Grant as I could. Grant and his nose bandage studiously ignored me. Julie was speaking. She stood at the head of the table to give her briefing.
Dr. Jonas Turley was considered one of the premier experts on the religion, art, and history of the ancient civilizations of this continent. He wrote over 20 books on those subjects and has done research and been a major part of archaeological digs from Alaska to Argentina. I got to hear him speak once in Birmingham. The man knew his stuff. So why did the bad guys go directly to his house and beat him and his wife to death? They tore apart all of his possessions looking for something, something important. I've got an idea as to what.
She let slip a brief moment of pride as she made us wait for the answer.
While Pitt was bluffing that he was going to blow up the Antoine Henri, Darnay said that this Lord Machado had some sort of artifact and that he was going to take it to a place of power to use it. Dr. Turley had done a lot of research concerning ancient religious sites. His last book was about that very subject, and the word in the academic community was that his next paper was going to be an exhaustive catalog of sites and what their importance was. My theory is that the bad guys went to his house for information. They are looking for a particular place, this place of power, so they can use their artifact.
What does this artifact do?
The senior Shackelford asked.
I'm the historian. Ask the psychic.
She pointed at me.
I'm no psychic. I just have a strange old Jewish man that visits me in my dreams and takes me on wild and crazy adventures. Hey, that sounds like a children's book.
"What does the artifact do?" repeated the head boss patiently.
"I don't really know, but I was told that the evil comes. The cursed one will bring it. We stop it if we can. If not, time will die."
"Time will die?"
"That's what the old man told me. I saw a storm coming. It brought Armageddon with it."
"I see. That would probably be bad. Carry on, Jules,"
Mr. Shackelford ordered. Julie continued.
"We need to figure out what this place of power is. Then we can get there first and set a trap."
"For 7 master vamps? How are we going to pull that off?"
Sam asked.
"We got any nuclear weapons stashed?"
"Well, actually..."
"Ouch!"
Milo started to speak, and Harbinger painfully kicked him under the table.
"Whoa. I had no idea what we had stashed in the basement, but I wasn't even willing to consider that." I forcefully banished the thought of Milo Anderson, armed with a thermonuclear weapon, out of my brain.
"We will think of something, but right now we need to gather information. We need to find out where Turley's places are and which one is the right one. We need to keep an ear out for any sign of these monsters, and we need to keep searching the archives until we find out who Lord Machado is and what this artifact does."
"No luck with the search yet," Albert Lee told us. In the last few days, he had become our unofficial librarian. "There are a lot of books down there, and no offense, but your cataloging system absolutely sucks."
"And a lot of the archives got burned in 95, Sam said.
"About 95. When do we get to hear the story?" I asked.
Harbinger shook his head.
"We'll get to it, but later."
"There is one person who knows all the stories in the archives better than anybody," Milo suggested. "If anybody would know who Lord Machado is, it would be him."
The experienced hunters gave each other incredulous looks. Milo's suggestion went over like a lead balloon.
"No way,"
Harbinger ordered with some force.
"I forbid it,"
Mr. Shackelford said.
"Milo, don't be stupid," Julie snapped.
She visibly paled at whatever the red-bearded man was suggesting. I had never seen anything shake her like that before.
"But if this artifact is really going to end time or blow up the world or whatever, don't you think it is worth the risk?"
Milo argued.
"This isn't just a normal case. We're talking about some serious stuff. He's mad at all of us, but he would talk to Julie."
"But I don't want her to talk to him. He's dangerous," Harbinger stated flatly.
"Earl, he's still her dad. He wouldn't try to hurt her."
"I've got 97 dead hunters that say otherwise. End of discussion, Milo. Don't bring it up again."
Milo leaned back in his chair and rested his palms on the table.
"Fine. Forget I said anything. Just don't blame me when the world blows up."
The conference room was uncomfortably silent. Julie just stared at her hands. And I had thought that my family had problems.
"We do have other options,"
Harbinger broke the silence.
"We can talk to Turley's colleagues, see if any of them know anything about a place of power. He had to confide in somebody. We'll need to be discreet, though, or the feds will find out. When I called and told them about the 7 vampires, they knew right where to go."
"They could have tracked us there," I said. "The hind does stick out a bit."
"Possibly, but I don't want to assume that. Even if they did, they're probably in the same boat we are, and they will be interviewing the same people. Word gets back to Myers, and we're screwed."
"We could knock Pitt out and see if he has any more dreams," Grant offered.
"Or I could try to divine the future with your entrails. I hear that works with chickens," I replied.
He glared at me. Julie shook her head in resignation. I had never promised to play nice.
"There are some other sources we can go to, though. There are others out there who are more in touch with, I guess you would say the magical world and all of this place of power mumbo-jumbo. Or if Lord Machado is evil enough, they may even be able to sense his location, Milo suggested. We could pay a visit to the Elf Queen. Not a bad idea. If we bring a good enough offering, she may speak to us, Julie said. Whoa, back up. Wait just a minute. Are you trying to tell me that there are really elves? Trip said. Yes, Trip, there are elves, she told him. I refrained from asking if they lived in a magic tree and made delicious cookies. Like as in J.R.R. Tolkien elves? Trip asked again. His eyes lit up in wonderment, like a kid who still believed in Santa on Christmas morning.
Old J.R. was quite the character. He learned from a few British hunters who knew their stuff, always hanging around them and picking their brains about languages and whatnot, the senior Shackelford wheezed. He did tend to romanticize things a bit in his writing, however.
I can't believe it, Tripp told us. It's just that this whole time all I've learned about is horrible, ugly things. Evil things and dead things that hurt people. I mean, I understand that our job is to fight them, so we have to know them. But I didn't know that there were good and magical things, too. This is great.
Son, just remember, old J.R. did tend to exaggerate to spin a good yarn. Real life ain't always like the books or the movies, Mr. Shackelford warned.
He glanced at his antique watch.
We got time. Sounds like somebody is taking a trip to the Enchanted Forest. Go with them if you must, Mr. Jones. Milo, it was your idea, so you're in charge. Take Pitt, too. I reckon he's the psychic.
The Hind set down in Boonville, Mississippi, a few hours later. Our target was actually closer to the town of Corinth, but Skippy refused to land any closer to the Enchanted Forest than we had to. He did not share his reasons, and Milo Anderson, who was leading our little expedition, did not feel the need to argue about it. Luckily for us, there was a place in town to rent a car. Sadly, the only available choice was a Ford Escort station wagon. The air conditioning wheezed, hissed, and died before we had gone 5 miles heading north on 45.
Now, when we get to the Enchanted Forest, don't speak unless spoken to, and try not to stare at them. They find that insulting.
Because they're so beautiful? Trip asked.
Probably something like that.
Milo was driving. I was in the passenger seat, knees crushed uncomfortably into my chest. Spacious interior legroom my ass. Trip and Holly were in the back seat. When it came to monster research or interviewing Dr. Turley's associates, most of the newbie squad was pretty useless at the compound. Lee was having a great time exploring and organizing dusty books and journals back at the archives. He had found his niche. As for the rest of us, we were still working on that. I decided that the hole in my gums was done bleeding, and I spit the wad of gauze out the window. The Novocaine had worn off, and my face hurt. Milo continued speaking, stroking his beard absently. Today he had removed the beads and was going with just a simple braid. He had dressed up for the occasion with a purple paisley shirt and green pants.
Let me do the talking. Etiquette is very important to their people. If they ask a question, answer it, but don't try to make small talk. They can be very touchy and secretive.
I bet it's because they're so ancient and wise, Tripp said. Holly put her finger in her mouth and made a gagging noise.
Hey, laugh all you want, but I grew up poor in backwoods Florida with an immigrant single mom. I'm the only person in my family who learned to read, and that was only because of comic books at first, and then fantasy novels and an active imagination. I got addicted to them when I was a kid and read like crazy. I must have read thousands of them. so I've been reading about elves and that kind of thing for 20-plus years. I can't help it if I'm excited.
You were a geek, she said.
Well, I guess. I bet you played Dungeons and Dragons in a friend's garage.
Well, yeah.
Nerd.
Hey, now,
Trip protested.
Since you were such a nerd, how did you manage to get so buff?
Well, one day I learned that I could run really fast with a football, paid for college.
Still a nerd at heart, though, aren't you?
Ooh, magic elves.
She actually mimicked him rather well.
Happy fairy magic wonderland.
Holly, quit picking on the nerd,
I shouted.
You should talk, spreadsheet boy.
You kids, don't make me stop this car,
Milo said as he turned on the radio and cranked the volume as high as it would go. The channel was Spanish-language love songs, but it succeeded in finally drowning us all out. The miles flashed by. Deep green trees and farms, cows and goats, interspersed with patches where out-of-control kudzu vines had managed to kill off all of the native vegetation. Kudzu was the real monster of the South. The open windows only served to circulate the hot, damp air. Sweat rings formed in my armpits and spread down my chest, quickly soaking through my dress shirt. We stopped at a Piggly Wiggly in Corinth. Milo did not explain what we were doing. We three newbies bought sodas and tried to stay in the air conditioning as long as possible. Milo purchased a shopping cart full of supplies and loaded them in the back of the station wagon while a large fan distracted the rest of us. He had to honk the horn to get our attention. Milo drank a Sprite while we headed out of Corinth. He pointed out a spot on the map. Here is the Enchanted Forest. The locals pretty much know to leave it alone. Now, for future reference, this area over here is known as Natchy Bottom. Do not ever go there. MHI has had a few cases in the bottoms over the last 100 years. There are some places on Earth that you just shouldn't mess with. Some out west, a couple in Maine, one in the New Jersey Pine Barrens, places that are just pure evil. That is one of them. That place is just plain bad. The people that live out there are pretty strange and keep to themselves. Heck, they didn't get electricity until the late 90s. There is some crazy stuff back in those woods that you just don't want to mess with. He did not elaborate further. We took a series of turns, heading deeper and deeper in the hills. The few scattered houses we passed became shoddier and older as we went. The last few houses we saw were so dilapidated that it was surprising that anyone was able to live in them. But the lights were on, and dogs roamed the trash-filled yards. The woods grew thicker, older, and darker. It rained briefly out of the clear, hot sky. The rain was warm and quickly passed, serving only to increase the already brutal humidity. Finally, we stopped in front of a small sign. It read, Enchanted Forest, in big letters, and Trailer Park, in smaller letters underneath.
Probably a trick to keep outsiders away,
Tripp told us.
Milo sneezed loudly as he had an allergy attack. The escort's tires crunched over pea gravel as we entered the Enchanted Forest.
It looked like a trailer park to me, and a run-down one at that. The trailers were rusty and old. Cardboard served as windows in places. Garbage and beer cans were strewn everywhere. Milo swerved around what appeared to be a pile of used disposable diapers. There were a few old cars, but it had been a long time since they had been mobile. Most of them were up on jacks or cinder blocks, tires long since rotted away. There was no life to be seen other than a couple of mangy dogs trying to stay in the shade. I could hear the sound of televisions through some of the open doors. Somewhere a baby cried. Milo stopped the car in front of a double-wide trailer with a no-longer-used giant satellite dish rusting in front. A rudimentary porch had been built out of scrap lumber. A recliner and a big faded couch were on the porch, and a fat, greasy dog was sleeping on the cushions. We exited our little vehicle.